Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
I'm probably in the dark.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Welcome to sort of the next round of Issues for Faithful Voters. So, way back in October, we were talking about sort of specific topical issues. We talked about healthcare, we talked about some other things. I can't remember what they were, but I'm sure you do very well and you learned a lot. We had, the last 2 weeks, we had John Sproul talking with us about loving your enemies. In a sort of political world where people who disagree with us or said the wrong thing at some point are treated as the enemy, how do we love each other, and how do we really understand each other's viewpoints rather than just sort of beating each other over the head with our own viewpoints? During the previous conversation, before loving our enemies, we had a request to talk about some of these words that we use to beat each other about the head. And one of the words that that sort of prompted that was the word socialism. And so I want to take a day to sort of try to decode what the word socialism means when it gets used, and I'm saying that in the passive voice intentionally, when it gets used in sort of our modern political conversations. Why would I call this an issue for faithful voters? I was sort of sitting with that trying to figure out kind of what is important to me about being able to use a word in a way that is more fair rather than less fair. And I was reminded of that one commandment. You know that one commandment? Not to bear false witness against your neighbor. And I think we use, socialism is not the only word we use this way, but I think we use some of these words really as a way of bearing false witness, as a way of mischaracterizing what someone else is saying. Now, we're not always bearing false witness when we use the word socialism. Coming particularly from the right, the word socialism is very often used, I'm going to say, as a way of mischaracterizing someone else's position. Coming from the left, it can also be misused as a way of mischaracterizing someone else's position. There are also people who will use the word socialist to describe themselves. And so one of the questions is, what do they mean when they say that? So I'm trying to sort of keep two sides of a coin together here. One is the side where we say words mean things, right? That you can't just throw the word, any word, at someone, and it just means whatever you think it means. On the other hand, meaning is also very contextual, right? As the old Bible scholar said, words mean what they mean in the sentences in which they are used. Words mean what they mean in the sentences in which they are used. Because the context in which we use a word also makes a difference about what we mean by that word. So I want to bring us some of that context, some of those differences in historical context and political context, what it seems to mean when it's used as sort of a self-characterization. But first I want to ask, when you hear the word socialism, here I am abstracting this from context now, right? When you hear the word socialism, what do you hear? What, and not like what what sort of does it make you feel warm and fuzzy? Does it make you feel cold and angry? But does it, what content do you think that word has when you hear it?
Well, historically, to me, it means the government has taken over more programs.
The government has taken over more programs.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Total government involvement.
Total government involvement.
Sharing our resources so everyone has enough.
Sharing our resources so everyone has
That's
enough.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. I like that one.
You like that one? I didn't ask for your.
You just make as much fun of me as you want.
Always done out of love.
I can handle it.
I have heard it linked with communism.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a connection there with communism, and we'll talk about that.
I think it depends on who's, when I perceive it, who's making the statement.
Yeah.
Who's making a statement about how they're using socialism. For example, if it's if Bernie's saying something about it, it's usually preceded by the adjective democratic socialism. But if a far right person is saying something about socialism, they're generally connecting it to we have no more rights of any kind. Everything we do is going to get shared by, and the government's going to do the sharing. So
right.
It becomes a little more radical.
Yeah, so there's one usage in which, and I'm going to say that, I'm going to give you a sort of textbook definition for democratic socialism, and I'll want you to sort of to read that definition really carefully and see whether the way that Bernie Sanders uses the words democratic socialism, see if that
really
jives
fits
well with that definition. And again, words mean what they mean in the context of the sentences in which they are used. So what he means by it is what he means by it. And what that term may mean at a more abstract level is informative, but it's not necessarily right? In the context in which it's used. And then you've got on this other, the sort of when it's thrown from the other side, I hear perhaps you could apply the word totalitarian to the idea that, well, you have no rights of any kind. Yeah. And again, used the same word used in two different directions.
So what's your democratic?
Good. You want to dig into some of these?
So, well, I mean, what is your definition?
Sure. Okay, so I'm going to give you four definitions. Two of the term socialism sort of by itself, and then two with the word democratic connected in one way or another. So here we have, in general, according to the Random House Dictionary, the word socialism. A theory or system of social organization that advocates the vesting of the ownership and control of the means of production and distribution of capital, land, etc., in the community as a whole. So broadly construed, socialism is the idea of the community as a whole owning the means of production and distribution. So in some sense, you see here essentially no sort of private ownership of factories, farms, tables and chairs, coffee. Yes?
Sounds like what we now call a cooperative.
Sounds like what we now call a cooperative. So broadly construed, this does apply to, for instance, farmers' cooperatives, which are jointly owned by a whole group of farmers who together sort of buy from each other the grain that they produce, and share with each other the proceeds of selling that onto the market. So, and there are historically different levels at which socialism operates, and the roots where the term socialism also did derive had a lot to do with these cooperatives and trade unions and labor guilds, and often had a utopian sort of narrative behind them, that we're gonna create a community where everything is owned in common, and within that community where everything is owned in common, everybody's needs will be met, and as a community, we don't have to fight with each other over who has what. You can see this idea really developing sort of in the modern era among especially Christians and fringe Christian groups especially, who are sort of separating out away from the mainstream capitalist Europe and North America, and wanting to build something different. They're going to find the roots of this actually all the way back into the New Testament, and even if they read it right, the Old Testament. I should say if they read it in a certain way. There are other ways to read the Old Testament. You've got at the end of the second chapter of Acts, right after the Holy Spirit comes on the church, everybody holds everything in common and nobody claims anything for themselves. What have they done there? They have given up the concept of private property and formed a commune. Now, that doesn't last very long. Utopias tend not to last very long. So that's just a little bit of historical perspective on the idea as a whole. But there's the idea as a whole. And so the idea that what we need should be collectively owned is, broadly speaking, socialism. Here is Marxist-Leninist socialism. So in the 19th century, a couple of German political theorists named Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels were looking around them at kind of the humanitarian wasteland that was 19th century industrialism, and said, this is awful. People are being oppressed and exploited for their labor, and the people at the top are making all the money. And so they developed an economic and political theory that said what needs to happen is that the people, the workers particularly, need to, one way or another, get their hands on the means of production. Means of production is going to be a Marxist term. So the factories, the land, the tools, and their own labor. They need to have control of their own labor. And this developed into an economic and political theory. And the theory took the name communism. So this is where we've got a distinction, perhaps, between the words communism and socialism. But some of that is just a matter of which language you happen to be speaking in. Until the Soviet Revolution of 1918 in Russia, when Lenin and the Bolsheviks come to power in Russia and explain what they're doing in a very particular way. Because, again, the communist idea is that the people as a whole, I mean, much more sort of the general definition of socialism, that the community as a whole, the people as a whole, should together own the means of production and provide for everyone in the community. Then Lenin had to explain why he had taken over a state, a national government, in order to do this. And so he explained, drawing on Marx's ideas, that there's a transitional stage. And the socialist stage, he said, is a transitional stage between capitalism over here. I'm doing this the wrong direction. I'm moving from left to right for you. So capitalism over here, right, where the rich get rich and the poor get poorer, there's this transitional stage when we have taken the means of production away from the capitalists, but the people, this is the goal over here, is communism, pure sort of, again, utopian, right? Communism, where the people as a whole own all the means of production and just provide for each other and everything's happy and puppies and butterflies, right? And in between, what you have is a situation where the people aren't ready yet, but the capitalists can't have it anymore. What you have is socialism, which is state socialism, which is the imperfect implementation of collectivist principles, says Random House. Again, they identify this one as Marxist socialism. And the idea being that, okay, this isn't great, but it's better than that. So, but it's not as good as where we're headed. Where we're ultimately headed is that everybody just collectively together, utopian, owns everything in common with each other. What did that take? For about 70 years, right?
Correct.
In the Soviet Union. There are other sort of Marxist-derived states in the world today. So you've still got you've still got the People's Republic of China, you've got the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, you've got Cuba's in a funny sort of weird transition, similar to the transition that China's in, actually, where a lot of sort of capitalist processes are taking root again. But boy, that's complicated. But this sort of Marxist-Leninist, Bolshevik-Stalinist flavor of socialism is sort of what that looked like in the 20th century. But we also have democratic socialism, which both Random House Dictionary and Wikipedia, which again, I'm actually going to cite Wikipedia not because it's an authoritative source, but because it is a consensus source. The way Wikipedia works, actually it just used more words to get where this is going. But the way that Wikipedia works is, this sounds a little socialist, everybody sort of makes edits to a given article on a given topic, and everybody sort of phrases things neutrally enough that kind of regardless of your viewpoint, everyone can agree that this is what we're talking about. So we're going to talk about democratic socialism, and then we're going to flip the term around and talk about social democracy. And this is complicated, so watch carefully. Democratic socialism as a theory is still a basically Marxist approach. So you've got the Bolsheviks with what becomes totalitarian socialism, that we have to violently seize the means of production and the state that controls them now, so that we can enforce the way this is supposed to work. Democratic socialism has the same goal in mind, and I'm going to say that this is not probably the sense in which Bernie Sanders means it, although you just never know. This is not generally the sense in which the term democratic socialism is used in the United States. Usually, when the term democratic socialism is used as a self-identifier in the United States, if you were to translate that into European, you would have social Democrat, which is a different thing. So, but this is in sort of as a Marxist ideology that transition to socialism or more purely communism, but using democratic processes to get there rather than using the violent overthrow of a state power and the seizure of those means of production. So, and then you've got sort of that that cheap phrase in there, or a modified form of socialism, which is sort of, that's going to be your overlap between democratic socialism and social democracy. A gradual transition to socialism using democratic processes. That's democratic socialism. In European politics, you'll have social democratic parties. Canada is European for these purposes, incidentally. So they also spell all their words with U's in them. That's how you can tell they're European. So social democracy is a European political term. One moment. I didn't actually get the definition re-translated in there. Look at this for a moment. I'll be back. No. Okay. See, sometimes you just screw that up, don't you? All right. So I'm going to give you new words in just a second. Social democracy in 5, 4, soon and very soon.
Soon and very soon. We're going to see.
There. Okay, like I said, here is social democracy in the way that it's used, for instance, in Europe. A political, social, and economic philosophy that supports economic and social interventions to promote social justice within the framework of a liberal democratic polity, so the idea is that this is not totalitarian, and a capitalist-oriented economy. So when you look at, for instance, Sweden, where many parts of sort of social services, the welfare state, to use another term that is often misused, when you look at the sort of the provision of social services, it looks broadly socialist in that sense, right? That social goods are delivered by the government as a whole. But the economy, sort of the place of corporations and manufacturing and so forth, is still individually or privately anyway owned, as in most other capitalist economies. So you've got this sort of having your cake and eating it too, which is in Europe, again, that'll be called social democracy. My hunch is that many American politicians who talk about themselves as democratic socialists probably sound more like social democrats, but that's I'm doing the thing I said not to do, though, right? I'm providing a word that I think someone else means by what they say, rather than listening to what they say about themselves, right? So we're going to give you basically a little video that's going to repeat the things I just said, because hearing things multiple times helps you learn them better. Looking at, okay, what is socialism? Again, in all of these different contexts. And then we're going to talk about how do we actually talk to each other, and the big each other, not just the people in this room at the moment, how do we talk to each other about a word that is this loaded? Okay? And there is an ad before. So, ride this motorcycle, then learn about socialism. Sorry, that's how you can tell you've got the good video.
Scandinavia, Bernie Sanders, and the Soviet Union have in common? Well, arguably the most misused theory of all time, socialism. The word is thrown around in popular culture and political discourse as both a pejorative and a compliment. But how can the same system be behind both the Nazi Party and Finland's world-class education system? What exactly is socialism? Well, in its most simple form, socialism is when a population collectively owns and controls the means of production and distributes the end result proportionally. In practice, however, control is usually delegated to the state, while the distribution usually comes in the form of underlying social welfare to satisfy everyone's basic needs like housing, education, and healthcare. The end-all purpose is to guarantee a level playing field for all members in a society, thereby removing class distinctions based on ownership. For example, in the US's capitalist society, high-quality education is expensive, meaning that those who can afford it are generally given better opportunities. Those who can't are forced to compete at a material disadvantage. This leads to class inequality, not on the basis of talent or ability, but on generational wealth. By comparison, in countries like Finland, where high-quality education is free, everyone is given the same opportunity to succeed or fail, regardless of their financial status. If that sounds a bit idealistic, that's because it's supposed to. Early socialism was predicated on the idea that if we could eliminate classes and have true societal equality, it would be a utopia. In fact, the earliest modern form of socialism was called utopian socialism. It's important to note that there are no 100% socialist countries, but rather different socioeconomic systems with socialist undertones. Even the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, which literally has the word socialist in the name, has been called a far cry from real socialism. The same is true of Nordic countries, which employ socialist programs combined with a capitalist economy. But why are the Nordic countries doing so well, while Russia is still recovering? Well, like any political system, socialism has a countless number of variations. The two most dominant are social democracy, as practiced by Sweden and Bernie Sanders, and the Marxism-Leninism form of socialism used by the Soviet Union, China, and Cuba. A social democracy generally prioritizes improving quality of life through equal rights and opportunities, bolstered by a state-run welfare system and on top of a capitalist economy. On the other hand, Marxism-Leninism prioritizes the infallibility of its dictatorship government. The rationale is that any benefit to the state would also be a benefit for the people. However, in practice, this has meant that the ruling party can massively depreciate the population's standard of living for the good of the state. Although both strive for similar utopian socialist goals, the way they approach them is very different. These examples show that socialism, along with its logical extreme, communism, may be backed by rational theory, but requires rational practice to go along with it. Socialist democracies are the happiest countries in the world. Other socialist-leaning countries, like China and Cuba, suffer from terrible human rights abuses like modern slavery and censorship. Maybe the best takeaway is not to trust anyone using the word socialism to describe radically different political theories. Just because salad is in the name doesn't make fruit salad, potato salad, and Caesar salad the same thing. If you'd like to learn more about libertarianism, anarchy, and other political ideologies, check out our full playlist here, starting with communism. Although similar ideas have existed both naturally and intentionally since the dawn of time, the most common form of communism comes from the work of German philosophers Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. That link is also in the description below. Thanks for watching Test Tube, and make sure to subscribe.
I wish I had come up with that line.
Yeah.
Just because the word salad is in the name.
Yeah.
So the presenter sort of drew us through that history a little bit of socialism coming from this sort of utopian idea that we can get rid of class distinctions, and the sort of one of the ways that this has played out historically is the Marxist-Leninist state, where class distinctions didn't go away, right? Another group of countries that could be that can be described under social democracy, that term, where good things happen and a capitalist economy continues alongside it. And I just said that as if a capitalist economy is not also a good thing that powers the other good things that happen. Those happiest countries in the world are themselves experiencing some real tension around what they mean when they say social democracy. And one of the big tensions that, for instance, those Scandinavian countries are experiencing is the question of, can we apply this welfare state to people who are new here? So something that that Switzerland and certainly Sweden and Norway and Denmark have that not all countries do is a very sort of ethnically uniform population. You have a population that can look around and say, yes, everyone in this room is definitely Swedish, right? Now, here we are in the United States, and we look around the room, and it's not necessarily clear that everyone in the room is Swedish, or German, or whatever sort of European national background we may bring with us as we come into this room. Some of us don't even have any clear couple of European national backgrounds in our past. So those otherwise happiest countries in the world are themselves running into some tension specifically around how do we provide this, or do we want to provide this, for people who are not ethnically like us? And that's a sort of a new point of tension, really, that has surfaced even after the production of this video. So I just want to acknowledge that even that is more complicated than the video is able to present for us. So I want to invite us to figure out how to ask the question, what do you mean when you say socialism? Whether that is coming as an attack, as a, you're just trying to do the same thing that, that failed in the Soviet Union, is failing in Cuba, should have failed in China, although they've done something different. They've got sort of totalitarian capitalism, you could say, in a way that is also problematic. Failed in many different ways and continues to resurge for a number of reasons in Latin America. It can be used to sort of try to catch all of those things in its blanket. It can mean a variety of other things, right? So I want us to figure out how to ask each other the question, what do you mean when you say socialism? And not necessarily as an attack, right? This is the This is from last week, the thing about using your values as a gift rather than a weapon, right? This word, socialism, and I could slide in here nationalism or fascism or racism or any of a number of other words that are so often used as a way to attack someone else, whether or not you're even attacking their viewpoints. They can be used as ways to attack rather than ways to gain clarity. So how can we invite clarity back into that conversation?
Well, I think you could add to that question, if mm-hmm. I was confronting someone, mm-hmm. rather than coming on as a confrontational kind of thing, you could say, what do you mean when you say socialism? So we're both on the same page.
Yeah.
Which then, in turn, would be, to me, an invitation for that person to at least define mm-hmm. what they're talking about, and then you could kind of see where you fit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you're adding that little phrase, so we're on the same page, as a way of kind of framing why you want to know, right? Because that can totally be weaponized itself as a statement, right? Oh, what do you mean socialism?
Right.
That's not what I'm talking, right? No, that's not where we're trying to go there, right? But yeah, so that we can get on the same page here, what do you mean when you're saying the word socialism? You know, if I'm talking about, you know, if I'm talking about a particular approach to providing health care for everyone in the country, or I'm talking about any of the other things that sort of in argument can also be pointed at. Well, that's socialism, right? City streets, commonly owned by the community, for the benefit of everybody in the community. There's an argument to be made that that's socialism. And it's usually made argumentatively to push back against, what do you mean socialism, right? But yeah, that, so we can get on the same page here. What do you mean when you say socialism?
I think you were describing context.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is what I had to take a course called Christianity and Communism in seminary. And one of the questions that I had to answer was, how did communism get born? And, you know, we have Marx and Engels up here, you know, and what I found out was that Engels really was the brain and Marx was the mouth of the whole thing, and they got together. But, you know, why did they do what they did? And the answer was really kind of shocking. What was going on in Russia at that particular time and in many parts of the world was there was a terrific problem of famine, and poverty was rampant everywhere, and they wanted to do something about it. And Engels was preparing to go into the priesthood, and we're talking about the Eastern Orthodox Church now, and so forth. And what was going on in the priesthood really disturbed him, because while the poor were trying to find food, the priests were picking out elegant kinds of fabric for their new robes. So the church was involved, is what the point of the professor had me talking about. So it's important to understand why these things were born. Marx and Engels were not really bad guys. They were trying to figure out this whole bunch, but their ideology just backfired on them. You know? But a third of the world at that particular time became communist. It was incredible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how'd that happen? So it's very important to find out the context of where people are coming from.
Right.
Well, in context, the way you're talking could also be a suggestion on how we ended up with Social Security, which is also kind of a socialist program, because there you go again now.
It's got the word social right in. So I want to give Russ a chance to weigh in just because he's got to bug out.
Well, from the definitions that I saw on the screen, it occurred to me that socialism is a transition to the ideal of communism. Mm-hmm. So these countries that call themselves communist never really got there.
Right.
That's exactly right, Russ. That's exactly right.
It got stuck in the transition.
So there are a couple of other really sort of interesting videos, a couple of which I didn't go with because the person just talked too fast because he was fitting a whole lot of history into a little tiny bit of time. And it's a fun video, although he banters with himself a little bit more than he needs to. I think this is the one that, as you said, Roger said, yeah, of course, the idea of social security being a socialist program in the definition there, right? The collective ownership of something, of capital in this case, right, for the benefit of everyone in the polis, whatever the size of the community is, in this case, a nation. So Russia happened in 1918, and it was already really threatening to the United States. And so there's a whole really interesting history of the term socialism in the United States that the term doesn't have quite the same history in Europe, for instance. But there's a whole very interesting political history of the term socialism in the United States because it's this thing that someone else does. And it's this threat to the sort of the capitalist system of the United States. It is very much a critique of the capitalist system of the United States. That's where the terms all came from, right? Even before Marx and Engels got their hands on it, the idea of utopian socialism, you don't need a utopia if the world is okay, right? You only need a utopia if the world around you is already broken. So the way that you shape your utopian idea is itself a critique of the way the world is. So if in your utopia everyone has to own everything in common, what you're saying is that everyone sort of owning their own stuff and duking it out between themselves is a problem. And we could debate whether and in which ways that's a problem, but that's sort of implied in the idea that we need something else to go in place of this. So all through the 20th century, there have been these sort of recurrent sort of flare-ups of we have to do something about socialism. We have to get the socialists out of the sort of the American political process, including in the 1920s. Now, what was happening in the 1920s? And then the 30s, the 1920s were sort of, yay, everything's great, and then
the Depression,
right? And so there was already this, there was already this, oh, just look what just happened in what is now the Soviet Union. Okay, we're okay, and then all of a sudden, we're not, right? The Depression sort of crashes on us in the financial market sense. In the agricultural world, the Depression started long before it started. And then you've got, resurgent socialism, because everybody's looking around and saying, oh, capitalism broke. I mean, that's one way to look at what the Depression was a failure of capitalist markets. So we need to do something about that. But we also need to keep the socialists at bay, right? And so the New Deal can be read as basically a concession by a party that does not have the word socialist in its name in order to prevent the party with the word socialist in its name from taking power. So you can read the the birth of Social Security and Medicare and the whatever, all the pieces that went into the New Deal, including a jobs program, right? You could just go work for the government doing things. And you can read that as a way of keeping socialism so named outside the political sphere so that the political sphere stays stable and capitalism can recover, which it did. It may or may not have taken World War II to get there. And then immediately after World War II, what did we do? We had another Red Scare. And we fought the rest of the Cold War. And so there have been these sort of, this cyclical sort of argument in the United States over whether the word socialism should be admitted to the public square. You could say that what's going on right now is an argument about whether the word socialism should be admitted to the public square. And then you can, or in the process, you can try to figure out, what do we mean when we say that? So next week, we're going to give you something completely different. Next week, I'm going to be gone. Roger Todd is going to take us to one of those utopian communities, the people who landed at Plymouth Plantation, or the Plymouth Colony in what is now Massachusetts. There were already people there called the Massachusetts. He's going to sort of take us through a little bit of what you really ought to know about, like, what really happened in the stories that became the first Thanksgiving. They didn't call it a Thanksgiving because they were eating, but that's part of the story. So Roger's going to take us through sort of what you should know about what that whole sort of colonial relationship was like. So it's a step away from this faithful voters thing, except that there are a lot of Native Americans still around, right? And a lot of our relationships with the Native Americans are founded on mythologies like the first Thanksgiving. And so to be faithful citizens in relationship with these other nations that live among us, it probably helps to know what part is mythical and what part actually happened. So it's a little bit of a detour because of the season, and it's a little bit of, you know, keep in mind this whole, you know, what are we talking about when we talk about X, Y, or Z? So then we will be off December 1st. That's the tail end of Thanksgiving weekend. We'll be off then. We'll come back December 8th for something. I haven't planned it yet, but it'll be great. And then we will be off until January.
Oh.
So I know. Yeah, so Thanksgiving falls really late this year.
Yes, it does.
And Christmas doesn't fall particularly late, which means December is really short all of a sudden.
Thanksgiving is 5 Sundays. I mean, November.
November
is,
yeah,
five.
There's five. Is that? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's 5 Sundays in December. There can't be 5 Sundays in November at the same time. There's only 4 in November.
People to serve communion.
Yes.
4 in November, 5 in December.
Yeah, 5 in December. Yeah. So we will be off December 1st, which is the tail end of Thanksgiving weekend, and that's kind of what's weird about it. Back the 8th, we always break starting the choir cantata Sunday, which is December 15th. So then we'll come back in January. So that's your big picture. Next week, come learn about the pilgrims who didn't call themselves that.
One last comment.
Yeah.
You know, be it socialism or communism, and you mentioned communes, that we have demonstrated that they have a short life expectancy. Mm-hmm. We don't have any glowing examples, a smashing success of a commune
or socialism in a country. And I'm not saying that capitalism is perfect.
Right.
If you're striving for perfection, you know, that's going to be pretty tough to find anywhere in this world. But I just wish that some of these scholars would not ignore the history. You know, if you don't learn from history, you beat it. And they're willing to, well, just because it hasn't worked in the past, you know, folks. And boy, the statistics of people, young Americans, that are thinking that some of the socialism's not bad. Where's their history?
Right. And so that's one of the places where it makes these conversations difficult, doesn't it? Because on the one hand, it is, well, what's appealing about that to you, right?
In theory, it is appealing.
Yeah.
In theory.
Right. And so what's appealing about that? Why does it seem like something we ought to take some lessons from? And what are the lessons of history that have to come along with that? Because you're right, that sort of collective ownership piece is not very long-lived. The collective provision of services, for instance, Social Security, is wildly popular in the United States. There's often, there's often sort of a, you know, I'll push back on everything, but keep that piece coming, right? So I don't know if that's, you know, or at what point do those historical problems also creep into that system, right? Creep into, for instance, a socialized medicine system, and I'm trying to use those terms really carefully, but a system where the government provides healthcare, financially speaking, to the populace as a whole, which works as long as the populace can kind of look around itself and say, yeah, we're all one thing, which is sort of that's the same condition that other sort of collectivist movements have had, that, you know, like, this is great so long as we're all us, right? But then once our sort of social ties get strained, then it's hard for me to share in common ownership of whatever it is with you. So yeah, it's historically really messy. And when we say either, you know, this is the solution to everything or this is the root of all problems, whether we're talking about socialism, capitalism, you know, and any other sort of approach to structuring a political economy, if we say, yeah, that's all perfect, or yeah, that's all awful, we can't really have that historically informed conversation. You're right.
And most of the countries don't have the luxury of having a government that will increase the national debt endlessly.
Uh-huh.
When I taught first at DMAC, we had a $5 trillion national debt, and we're all shaking in our boots. Every semester I plotted it.
Uh-huh.
And showed what the per capita was. Mm-hmm. Now we're over $20 trillion, and they're going to expand the debt this month on a continuing resolution. See, how many countries have an unlimited credit card? That's the only way that we're able to get by some of the socialist practices that we're already engaged in.
So that's what do we do about the national debt is a really, and it's a messy problem. Right? If you try to actually do something about the national debt, I mean, I don't know all of what goes into it, but it's more complicated than simply paying off, you know, a home mortgage. But,
oh, yes.
Right? So, there's a lot of, you know, we could spend a whole long time on some of these. Yeah. So thank you for making sure that we're staying sort of historically rooted in sort of historically and economically rooted in how the world has proven itself to work. So, come back next week. Don't expect turkey.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.